Hey there, folks. I am Rob Allen, co-CEO of the People Stack, along with Jen Bunk. In this episode of the People Stack podcast, I sit down with author and consultant Aviv Ben Yosef to talk about smaller teams with smaller egos, leading teams worth leading, leadership as a profession, connecting tech teams more closely to business outcomes, and how that connection is so closely related to startup success. We also dive into how you can actually gather real experience, not just accumulating years on your resume. Stay tuned for this one.
Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Bunk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode.
Hey there, everybody. I'm Rob, and I am here with Aviv Ben Yosef, coming to me live all the way from Israel. There's now a 13-hour time difference between the two of us, but through the magic of the interwebs, here we are chatting. Aviv is a technical executive consultant, and he helps technical executives help to make sure that they have teams that are worth leading. And I am really excited and interested to hear how you got to that specific niche, Aviv, and also really what aspects of that role bring you the most joy. So you want to lead us in with that and tell us a little bit about yourself and where how you got to this place.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure. It depends on how far back you want to go. I was very technical from a young age. Like I taught myself coding when I was 9 or something around that age. And during the high school, I started being interested with hacking because I really wanted to understand how things work. And if you break into them, you usually have to really understand how everything's working. And the problem was that I was a kid. I didn't want to get into trouble. I kept seeing, articles about hackers going to jail. So I'm like, what am I going to do? And being Israeli, I said, okay, I'm fairly sure that if I hack Iranian government servers, no one's going to, I'm not going to get extradited to Iran. So that was my thinking. So as a kid, I started searching for, .gov.ir servers. And I would just hang into those as practice. I didn't do anything, right? I didn't understand Farsi, so I didn't understand what I was seeing anyway. But like the second I got active, I was like, okay, nice, and I just moved on. And then I got to age 18, where you get compulsory service here, and I got into basically the equivalent of the NSA over here. And I remember that as I was doing the whole process of the interviews and everything, they asked me, did you do, digital crime, something like that? And, again, me being a good kid, I'm like, oh, crap, this is good. This is gone. I'm going to, I'm going to be a real soldier. I'm not going to be doing the stuff I want to do. And I tell them everything I just told you. And they're like, oh, okay, sure. They just take, they have a ready form for it. And I'm like, okay, just sign here that you're saying you're never going to do it again. I'm like, okay, sure. And apparently they were used to kids doing that sort of stuff. Maybe that's how they found us. I don't know. So I did that at a really good time over there. But what was amazing for me, and this connects to sort of the trajectory of the rest of my career, is as I got into service, and we have reservists. So, regularly you get people who finish their service, which usually you do by the end of 21, 22. You get people who are 30, 40, who you can bring back for a few days every year to help you and go over old systems or just train you because they have a bunch more experience, etc. And essentially, each and every one of them that we brought in, they had good intentions, but all of them told us, a bunch of 18-year-olds, you guys don't even realize it yet, but this is going to be the best team you'll ever work with. Because they said, you know, this is so unique. This is such a special atmosphere. This is just something that you have to really cherish. And I agree now in hindsight, I don't know, too many years later, like 18 years later. And still, I remember hearing that. And I was thinking to myself, this is it. Like, I'm 18 and I'm now at the top. What am I supposed to do with the rest of my life after this? And ever since, just like you said in the intro, I've decided that it doesn't make sense for us to let go of just living average careers, leading average teams. I want to strive for something that's memorable. So after the Army, I worked at IBM for a year and I ran away because it was IBM. I was first employee at startups. I did freelancing for a bunch of Israeli startups. Many of them ended up getting acquired, IPOing, and are now unicorns, etc. I learned a lot. But after a while, I realized that there was only so much I can help companies by being the person that, you know, makes the keyboard go clickety-clack really fast. And I saw that actually the hallway conversations I was having with my clients, the founders that brought me in, were actually even more important to them because I was talking to them like, you know, did you ever consider this and that? Or, you know, I've been to five companies that worked similarly, and I think that you guys are missing this part, that sort of stuff. And that slowly started a transition. And for the past 5 or so years, I've been doing what I'm doing now, which is coaching and advising CEOs, VPs of engineering, and also CEOs about making the whole product engineering beast in the startup or in tech companies become something that's an impact machine as opposed to a feature factory.
Wonderful, wonderful. As somebody who's been part of feature factories in the past, thank you for that. It's remarkable how much or how similar your trajectory sounds to mine. Of course, I dreamt of being able to work for the CIA, NSA. You actually went and did it for your local branch, your local version. And that's one of the interesting juxtapositions between growing up in America, growing up in Israel. As I was talking about prior to our conversation, one of our friends is a former fighter pilot for the Israeli military. And it's just like, that's just a thing you do. How?
Yeah.
So
as a 20-year-old, yeah.
Yeah, as a 20-year-old, that's just what you get to do. I mean, that's what teenagers here dream about. And then the military says, no, no, you're going to carry a rifle and you're going to hike for 16 miles with a 20-pound backpack. So when, you know, in my experience, those hallway conversations and understanding all of the stuff that happens outside of the keyboard clickety clack is really the thing that moves things. I think a lot of people had that realization. In fact, in that same 6 to 5 year trajectory, we're seeing a lot of people now focusing more in this particular area. What else, what changes have you noticed during those 5 to 6 years of, you know, the pre and post of focusing in on the team sport aspect of software development?
Well, that's an interesting question. So I think, first of all, that in general, tech has gone through quite a ride over the past 5, 6 years. Because we saw the VC money getting just, you know, easier and easier to get, which affected everyone, everywhere. Businesses were being contorted to not look at the bottom line, to grow like crazy. And I think that actually created a sort of a mini generation in our industry that has, you know, now taught itself something that no longer works because of the changes we now had. And, you know, we had COVID in the middle and a bunch of stuff. And people now basically have to reinvent themselves because what you were used to few years ago no longer works, no longer makes sense, will no longer get you your next round of funding. And in the past 6 months, you know, I talk to hundreds of startup founders of year. And in the past 6 months, I've heard more founders tell me that they're on the brink of having to close the company or I have actually closed them than I've heard in the 10 years prior. So I think that, first of all, we have a major shift in what it means nowadays to create a startup. And as part of that, if you want to lead an amazing tech team, if you want to have an R&D team that's worth the high salaries that we enjoy getting, you have to shift your gears and create a team that's focused on the business. I always say that you can place engineers on sort of a continuum. On one end, we have product, and on the other hand, we have the tech. So I, for example, when I was 18, I didn't care about whatever I was coding. Let me just do, you know, at the time it was something else, but now it would be something like, I don't know, I want to do Rust. I want to work in a programming language I never worked in before. I want to do code that's generative AI because that's all the hype. So that's the tech-oriented people, and you need some of those. But I think that right now, if you want to create a team that's really stellar, you have to make sure that more and more of the people are more towards the product end of the spectrum. Those are the people who are going to say, I don't care if I have to, you know, code assembly on a mainframe, as long as we're going to get the business results, because I care about the users. I care about seeing the success. You know, I'm not crafting code because it's pretty and I'm going to hang it up on the wall. I'm doing it because of whatever it achieves. And this is something that's crucial. And I'm seeing more and more people now realizing it. And I've been actually aligned like that for years, because this is what I've seen working back in the day in the Israeli intelligence corps. And I just saw it working. And I always say, if this worked for 18-year-olds who have no experience doing things that are, you know, are so critical, as in if the systems miss something, you just might hear later that you missed the opportunity to give a prior warning about an upcoming terror attack. And, you know, we as 18-year-olds did that. Yeah, kind of, right? So, you know, we had things like 6 months after I got enlisted, a soldier got kidnapped. And we were like, later realized, oh, yeah, well, there was a bug. And we might have been able to get that notification an hour earlier, which might have made a bunch of difference in finding and locating him before he was lost for like 5 years. That sort of stuff. And, you know, like if we let 18-year-olds do that, and in general, you know, Israel is there and it's surviving, you know, everything else considered. If we can do that, then surely the same model can work with people who have 10, 15, 20 years more of experience, a lot more budget, who are more mature in general, and who are doing things that, you know, with all due respect to all of my clients who do stuff, you know, like social media networks, or B2B SaaS apps that help to optimize a business and this niche or that. All of those things usually do not translate to lives being lost. And therefore, if that model worked there, it can work, I believe, in most of the tech teams around. So if you go for teams that are smaller, teams that have constraints, which I believe bring creativity, that sort of stuff, I think that this can create amazing teams that can create those highlights, that thing that so many people told me when I was 18, I'm never going to see again. I think this is a sort of a recipe that we can recreate. And in general, right now, if you want to lead a team that's genuinely a career highlight for your people, I think that bringing them closer to the business, helping them see the results of what they're coding, is going to make all the difference. Because then they can, you know, come up to you and tell you precisely what might be possible, because now they're thinking about that. So, you know, shower thoughts. We all get those shower thoughts and we're like, oh, this is just an amazing idea. When you're not connected to the business as an engineer, I know that I pulled it firsthand as an engineer in IBM where I was coding stuff, which I still to this day don't understand what they did. It just was, you know, I was following the specs. Your shower thoughts are going to be about, I don't know, your pet projects, or about whatever your hobbies are, or what, you know, what you're going to have for dinner. But when you're really connected to a problem, this is where your brain's going to go. I remember so many times that I was coming back from the army on a long bus ride, and I was closing my eyes, and all of a sudden, the code was in front of me, like Neo in the Matrix. Or later, as I was working with my clients as a freelancer, when I was really in it, I would just go to a shower and I would just come back, and it was like, it's late, and I'm like, no, I have to bang out this piece of code because I just had an idea, or I got an idea for a POC, and I would email the founders immediately. Hey, we talk about this and that tomorrow. And I want to see more of that. And you can do that if you bring people, give them the context, and actually connect them to what they're doing, so they don't feel like pawns, but actually can feel almost physically that what they're doing matters. And if you're doing hardware, it's easier because you can actually see things physically. But even in software, you connect us to the results. If you can help us see what users are doing, that's amazing.
Yeah, I think even in hardware, while yes, you can see a physical object that comes about at the end of the process, you still have to understand why you're building that physical product in order to make good choices about it. Now, we deal in the realm of tech careers, of dream careers and dream lives that go with it. So would you describe this as a dream for you? And how, what's the dream aspect for you?
Yeah, so I keep saying that I basically made up this job for myself. And therefore, it basically has to be something that I really enjoy doing. And that's, for me, that's saying a lot, because I've been doing this for, in this form of coaching and advising for the past 5 or so years, which is now the most I've done anything, the same for this long. And it shows for me that I'm probably right now having a good time and really enjoying it. Well, is this the end, of the road for me? I don't know if I'll keep doing the same thing for the rest of my life. I doubt it, because we evolve.
Oh,
and
yeah.
still right now, I just feel like people keep asking me. I've got a bunch of friends who are startup founders, and they keep asking me, oh, don't you have the itch to do something of your own, to start your own company? And I keep telling them that for me, there's something very, very rewarding in just knowing that I've helped many, many companies have success they wouldn't have otherwise. And, I see them years later, and they're doing amazing. They're growing. The CEOs still write to me from time to time saying, just want you to let you know that this is still helping us, etc. This is so rewarding. And I feel like I've got a lot more impact than I would have had I been, cooped up working on a single company. So for me, this is extremely rewarding. And also, talking about a dream life, I became independent right about when my wife got first pregnant. And ever since then, my kids have never seen me be an employee. I've been able to have amazing flexibility. And actually, with COVID, where most of my work transitioned to be entirely remote, I've had so much flexibility that I get to sort of, I feel like I'm doing something that should be illegal, because I basically see my kids all the time I want to. I work as much as I need to. Whenever there's something, a family occasion or just, a match in school, whatever, I can be there. And I keep seeing that this is not something that even a lot of tech people around me are able to do. And I feel like this is amazing. And probably in a few years, they're going to be embarrassed by me being there, and then this is going to stop being so important. But right now, this is the dream, being able to be there, being able to give my wife more time to work on her career. And, even just being able to take care of myself. And, I have my Italian lessons several times a week, just because I wanna. And hey, I can. I'm my own boss, so I can decide that I'm gonna put that on the schedule. It doesn't have to be something that happens when I retire. And
right.
Yeah, so to cut a long story short, for me, this is pretty nice.
Excellent. And one of the phrases that you used in your conversation earlier was the concept of mini generations. when you think about the current mini generation, either from the fast funding aspect of things, or from the COVID lockdown, everything goes remote thing, what are some of the challenges to staying connected to the product that you see in those individual mini generations?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, the COVID thing, I think, is something that we're still recovering from when it comes to thinking about what's management like in a world that's hybrid. If you're entirely co-located, people are used to, you know, we mimic some sort of management profession that we saw because, you know, someone was there, they were having these sorts of conversations. And now, when you're no longer able to see how long someone's in their seat, you know, sense, I'm not even talking about sensing whether they're working hard or not. But for me, when I was in offices, and especially as someone who used to go to a bunch of offices every week, I picked up on patterns. So if I would go and I would see that there's an engineer that all of a sudden tends to be more sitting by themselves, I know that maybe this is a person that's talking, that's working on something that's too hot for them, or they feel a bit lost. And as a manager, you can just see that, sense it, and go talk to them and see if there's really an issue. Or you know how you can spot there's a really spicy bug. If you see a debugging huddle, you see a bunch of engineers all crouching around one engineer, trying to understand what's going on. And if you see that as a manager, you can sense, okay, maybe I need to go there or later talk to them and see what was going on, etc. All of a sudden, if you're hybrid, this has become so much harder. And add to that the fact that during the previous mini generation, the scale up like crazy, easy money generation, people would become a manager just like that because, you know, you joined the company 6 months later, we doubled in size. A third of the people are now becoming managers. And in general, and I saw that globally, I work with people in Israel, in Europe, in the States, people would become engineering managers or team leads or whatever you want to call it without any real coaching or training. It's like, you know, like you dub at night, right? You tap their shoulders and that's it, rise, sir, whatever. That was the same with engineering. Like you do that and you flip a bit, you change the LinkedIn title, and now you're supposed to somehow magically possess the ability to be a manager. And we didn't think about management as a profession for so long. And now that we have the hybrid sort of way of working, it has become three times harder if you weren't used to it before. So I think that this is right now one of the main problems I'm seeing when I'm helping people, how to grow real managers, how to teach management as a profession in your team, how to create a culture that works given that you probably are still hybrid, or, you know, I'm working with companies that are entirely remote, that don't have an office. And how do we handle that? How do we even sense whether people are working? You know, people right now, I've been hearing about people saying to themselves, are my people working, or are they just using ChatGPT to pretend like they're working? You know, how can I know if we're remote? So I'm seeing a lot of that. And second, when you have people sitting in one office, it was very easy if there was, for example, a user interview or we have a nice demo or something, to just, you know, call people, whoever's interested can just drop by in a room for 15 minutes and see and witness by themselves who are the people who are coming, what demos are we doing, etc. And now, because I think a lot of the people realize that if you're remote, we all have Zoom fatigue and another meeting on your calendars look like, you know, it's one step removed from insulting you and that sort of stuff. We seem to be communicating only things that we think are crucial for the work, which is like, again, taking you to become a feature factory, because we're just talking about the features themselves and the work. And we cut a lot of the extra, which I think is actually what gives us that precious context. So this is something that I'm also very, very mindful of when I'm working with teams about the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, we need to talk less about the tasks themselves and trust the people that if you give them the right context, they will be able to make a bunch of the, you know, hundreds of micro decisions you make every day as a coder to make them correctly because you have that context. So instead of having a bunch of meetings to define every little bit, we give you a bunch of context, give you the problem to be solved, and trust you to talk to people if you need help. But in general, just do your thing. And this is, I think, something that is hard for many people. But if you do that, eventually it pays off.
Yeah, and I have experienced many of the same things. Most promotions or most elevations to management leadership here in the US are still battlefield promotions where somebody left and now, you know, you take one of your best engineers and you now lead the team. And here you're now responsible for the care and feeding of this team. Interesting that in both of those mini generations, that's going to be a vastly different experience with different levels of pressure, different outlets, and different levels of support. When you think of the level of support really required to take somebody who was an individual contributor and then get them to think in terms of my favorite word, the context that is now required at that higher level, what would you like to see in place for those kinds of organizations so that you can take people who are good with not just the code, but with the people who see the fact that coding is a means to an end. We're here to solve a problem, not to write more code, and then elevate them into that leadership role.
Yeah, so I think that one of the most important things for people who come from a technical background to become leaders, managers, is to, first of all, help them realize what's important and help them realize that what got you here won't get you there.
Right.
When COVID hit, all of a sudden I wasn't commuting to Tel Aviv, and I got a bunch more time. And I decided that I'm going to try and write down a bunch of the things that I kept seeing and kept repeating when I was working with first-timer tech executives, CTOs, VPs of engineering, etc. And that turned into my first book, the Tech Executive Operating System. And in there, I talked about exactly what you just asked. For example, how should your day look like? What does it mean to be an executive or to be a senior leader? Because a lot of people thought that just meant that they had to go to more meetings, but they still viewed themselves as, you know, as the tech person or as the geek. I'm not supposed to understand what the salespeople are talking about because, you know, I'm a geek, I'm a coder. Or if the CEO would be talking about the roadmap, they would just, you know, wait with the pen in hand to write down what they need to do and didn't think that, you know, it's okay to not just, you know, sometimes it was as simple as asking questions, but more than that, can you, you know, chime in and try and help shape the strategy, help us decide where we need to be going? Because especially if you're in a tech company, technology has to be one of the founding tenets on which everything's built. You don't just need to be an executor, you need to help shape the path we're gonna go. And add to that the fact that sometimes we look at the organization from sort of the mindset, the perspective that we had previously. I can tell you firsthand, as someone who was there as a senior engineer, the typical senior engineer is very sardonic, very cynical. If you watch Silicon Valley, it was this, you know, guiltful typecast who would keep saying, you know, nothing's gonna work, everything's a lot harder, whatever you're suggesting is a mistake or stupid. And that's the typical senior engineer that you would see in many, many startups, the person who was there on day one to tell you,
hey man,
3 years
those are
later
my friends.
Whatever idea you had. Yeah, exactly. Whatever idea you had no longer works. We tried that already, you know, yada, yada, yada. And when you get to a leadership role, you have to stop doing that, because especially as a leader, whenever you think that, you just usually just shut down the entire discussion. And I said that you have to shift your mindset to be this sort of a suspension of disbelief person. Maybe when you're talking to the CEO, you can be a bit more argumentative to make sure that you're not saying we're going to do something that's, you know, impossible. But when you're working with the people, when you're brainstorming, whatever, just let's assume that something's possible. When I enlisted and when I was 18, I thought that was, you know, a bunch of kumbaya crap. We had written on the wall, everything is possible. And I would look at it as a cynical 18-year-old. Yeah, everything's possible. Later, I realized that we were doing, you know, things as 18-year-olds with a, you know, about 1% of the budget, nothing compared in experience. We were doing things that are equivalents in the NSA, a bunch of PhDs, 100 times the people weren't getting. And that's what everything is possible is about. And that's basically why, you know, the reason why is because we would say, let's assume it's possible. What would it take for this to happen? And that sort of thinking was like magical. And I kept trying to make this sort of mindset happen in every company I was in. And all of a sudden, it just works. You know, for me as a chess hobbyist, I suck. I get my butt handed to me online by kids every day, but still I like the game. There's something about someone showing you a chess set and telling you, you know, what would you do now without any hint? And that's hard. And if I tell you, you know, there's a mate in three here, you're going to work really hard, but you're going to find it because I told you it was possible. And sometimes you just need your leader to tell you, this is possible, we can do it. Let's think about it. And once you do that, once you let go of being the sardonic engineer, all of a sudden your team starts being a lot more creative. You start doing things that you didn't think were possible. And that's, I think, very, very important as you transition into a leadership role.
Wonderful. So speak for a moment for the future that you see where most organizations have the anything is possible ethos, and that they're coming at it even with their junior engineers and their senior engineers with an aspect of this is possible, we'll figure it out, and that the solving the problem is the bigger thing versus what framework do I get to use, what language am I playing with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What world does that open up?
So first of all, I think it just opens up a world where we get those career highlights that I was talking about. You know, you no longer have to feel like, okay, I'm at 18 and I got to the peak, which I think is very important. But also, my second book just came out called Capitalizing Your Technology. And that's more for the founders who are not technical, who are looking at, you know, this army of very expensive geeks they have and are thinking, you know, is this working correctly? Do I need more people? Do I need less? They keep saying they need to refactor things. Does that make sense? Or they don't understand the business, whatever. And in there, I say that if you want to create amazing teams where you see this creativity, where people think that everything's possible and then come up with a bunch of ideas, it has to start at the top with everyone enabling this sort of culture where we're going to speak up. If there's something that I think works well in Israel, even if sometimes it's annoying, is the fact that we have this chutzpah where you allow yourself to say things, you know, even to someone who is your superior. In the army, for example, I think that we saluted like, you know, once or twice during boot camp, but after that, you rarely even speak to a highly ranked officer by addressing them by, you know, their title or whatever their rank. Usually it's going to be their name, unless we're talking about someone who's like the chief of staff. You're going to say something that's basically the name of the person and that's it. And that creates that you break the distance. There's not a lot of distance between people. And all of a sudden, we can all speak our minds. I remember being a corporal telling a lieutenant general that their idea is obviously crap and will not work. And here's another suggestion. And, you know, I had like 6 months of experience in the team, and I was actually in a meeting with a bunch of other officers as someone who's completely new there. But all, you know, it just so happened to be that they were talking about something that I knew really, really well. And I just said that, and no one got pissed. But even more than that, they just listened and they said, okay, let's check that. And, you know, 30 minutes later, my idea was the path we chose. No one had egos, or, you know, even if we had egos bruised, we didn't let that become something that got in the way of getting the job done. And this is something that you can really, really work towards. And that's the future, as far as I'm concerned. Smaller teams with smaller egos, where people voice their thinking. We remove the common sense filters. You know what's a common sense filter? It's when you feel like, I don't think I need to say that, because probably everyone here is smart enough to think about it already. So if this was a good idea, they would have said it themselves already. We want to create these sort of cultures. And second, we need to create space for exploration. So many amazing engineers I've seen who care about the product, who care about the business, when they feel like they don't have time to think about things, you know what they do? They do what, you know, a very diligent employee would do. They put their heads down and they just try and bang out all the tasks as fast as possible because they're trying to be good. That's really what they're thinking. And usually what ends up happening is that, you know, they do what you ask them to do, which is great. But if you give them just a bit of slack, just a bit of flex, so they can, you know, try things out, and they don't feel like every minute I'm wasting is a minute that I'm going to be behind on my deadline. When you do that, all of a sudden, they start thinking, they start being creative. You're not going to be really creative, you know, creativity as in I'm doing something that might not work because it's creative, it's novel, it's the first time I'm doing it. When you know that if you miss the deadline, someone's going to get really, really angry. You're not going to get promoted, etc. If you have a bit of flex, all of a sudden people start being more creative. They're going to try things out. Maybe they're going to play with GPT-4 for the first time. Even if they don't have a concrete idea for what it might mean for your company, just by tinkering with it, all of a sudden it's like, you know, learning a new language or learning a bunch of new phrases in a language, where all of a sudden you now can use those and you might notice new patterns you didn't notice before. Maybe just because they have a bit more time and they're connected to the business, they talk to the salespeople and they realize that the salespeople are wasting a lot of time doing some manual work. And, you know, an engineer sees that and automatically says, I think I can automate like half of that in a day. And this is not something that's usually in
and
the
now we don't need
work.
Salespeople.
No one would think about it. Yeah. No. We just help them run through the pipeline a bunch faster, or, you know, find those leads that actually make more sense faster, that sort of stuff. And I've seen that. And the magic is that you need to actually be connected to other people in the organization. Usually as an engineer, just getting, you know, you're getting your orders in air quotes from product in the form of Jira tasks or whatever. And you do that. No one's thinking about the other parts of the organization that we might help. And when we sort of break people out of this cocoon, when we break the silos and we let everyone work together, all of a sudden we can give not just our users, but people internally in the company, these software-empowered superpowers that can provide you with the ability to do things much faster. And now, you know, thanks to GPT, thanks to no-code and low-code tools, thanks to the advancement of tech, doing that for an engineer is a lot easier. Like, a day of an engineer might solve things that other people have wasted hours and hours every day without even realizing that it can be automated. That sort of stuff. And, you know, you can hear this is something that I'm very, very passionate about, because I feel like every time we do that, you know, an angel gets their wings, you're helping people do the work a lot faster. You're saving time. You're helping humanity. Okay. And maybe I'm exaggerating. Salesperson that's going to sell another widget to an enterprise company, but still, we're helping the world get better. We're helping people suffer less. I love it.
Thanks for giving me this quick moment for our sponsor, CoverageCat. We're very intentional about who we allow to sponsor the People Stack podcast. And when I connected with the folks at CoverageCat, I quickly learned that they are an excellent fit as a sponsor. If you live in Washington, California, Texas, New York, or Florida, CoverageCat is a free concierge service that will help you find the best price and coverage for your umbrella, car, home, and renter's insurance. And yes, loyal tech leader audience, we know that most of you need insurance, whether it's umbrella or other insurance to protect your wealth. We know how annoying dealing with insurance companies can be. So we love how CoverageCat is making this process super easy. Fill out one form and they compare across dozens of carriers to find you the best coverage and price while you skip the spam and sales calls. Get your free optimized insurance quote today at coveragecat.com.
So this is where I need to put on my my senior engineer curmudgeonly hat. What I've noticed, specifically with the GPT-based tools and a lot of that automation, a lot of the no-code solutions, is that you need to have a thorough understanding of the context and of the problem you're trying to solve before you're able to do that, which in my mind makes those, so in the metaphor or the story that you're talking about, it makes the salespeople far closer to the problem, more ready to solve the problem using no code, low code, GPT-based tools than the engineer themselves, because the engineer is coming at it from completely left field. When I've noticed engineers trying to do things with GPT, it tends to be taking that engineer mindset, the engineer thinking of these are the steps I need this code to go through, and then asking the GPT model to write that for you, which isn't really saving you much of anything. And so making that context shift, making that mindset shift, first of all, to focus on the problem space is necessary to leverage those tools. At least that's what my experience has been. Is that what you're seeing out there as well?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. When I work with companies on increasing their innovation, I say that, you know, we're used to in tech to have these hackathons, which is like a day or two where people work on things that are innovative, and that happens usually once or twice a year. And that's nice. And I see a bunch of pictures of companies doing that, posting them on LinkedIn, feeling like, oh, we're so creative and we're amazing. And that's better than nothing. But what it means is that you're caging your people's creativity and you're telling them you can only be creative, you can only be using your brain 2 days a year. But if you're trying to go for habitual innovation, you can go with something like, I call it intermissions in my books, 37 signals call it, I think, sabbaticals. Each company has their own name. We can start creating these little pockets of innovation that happen more regularly, once every 6, 7, 8 weeks. And when you have those, they usually are more than a day or two, but more towards a week where people do things that might fail. They're not sure it's going to work because it's genuinely innovative. And when we do that, I always make sure that this is not just the engineers trying to come up with ideas, you know, like a sort of a deus ex machina where they know better than anyone else in the company. Like, hey, salesperson, this is the tool for you. Hey, marketing person, try this thing out, as if we know everything better than anyone else. What I actually try and do is create a platform. At least we can't let people know that that's what we think. We need to help them, you know, save grace. But what I'm trying to do is help create these cultures where we create a platform where everyone can work together. And when that happens, for example, we pair marketing people and engineers, or we pair someone from sales and someone from the customer success team and an engineer to try and, you know, consider what might be improved. And usually after we do this 2 times, it clicks and you start seeing that salespeople become, for example, I keep saying salespeople because it's an easy example, but it really applies to everyone within the organization, marketing, customer success, even legal, where they once they see this, because they sat with the engineers and they realize how they're thinking, they become more tuned to noticing areas that might be a good opportunity to try something out. And that's when we get these collaborative innovation attempts where someone from customer success says, you know, I noticed that I keep, you know, having to handle these types of problems, which are not easy for us to script and whatever tools we're currently using. But it feels like this is something that we might be able to solve faster or save a bunch of time for the entire customer success team. Or you get someone from marketing telling you, you know, I keep feeling like this is what I know to do, how to do. The rest of the team keeps asking me how to do it. Can we think about a way to teach people, which is not me writing down a bunch of documentation, but can we try and do something that just learns from me? You know, these are real examples I saw. And sometimes the answer is, oh, no, you're talking about something that's only going to be possible in 5 years when technology gets there. Other times you get something that just works, and the rest of the time, usually you get something in the middle. So maybe it's not perfect, but it gives you a 10% improvement in how people operate. It gets to a part of the way there, or maybe it opens a window. And now this is something that we're going to be improving regularly every quarter, because we know that if we invest time in it, people are going to see the fruit and we're going to improve the ability of others within the company to work better. And this genuine collaboration, again, not us being the god coders who know everything and can solve everyone's problems given enough time and a keyboard that is really clicky. If we actually work together with people, you get that. And along the way, you get this sort of a positive feedback loop, because engineers are talking more to the salespeople, for example, or to the marketing people, mm-hmm. or to people from business development, and they actually learn what they're doing. These people become three-dimensional. If you ask any random engineer what a marketing person does, they would probably say something like, oh, they set up A-B tests and that's it, or they fire up ad campaigns and that's it. They don't really understand what those people are doing. The same goes in many, many professions. And once we actually work together, even if it's just on these intermissions, these innovation weeks, all of a sudden we start understanding what's going on around us, and we start creating things that are only now possible when we combine the experience, the knowledge, the thinking of people from a bunch of diverse backgrounds, and not just being dependent on what the engineers think or what the product people put on the product roadmap, but really create this amazing atmosphere where everything's possible. And now not in a cynical way. And I think this is something that's really unique.
And being a driver of that. So, and this is what I need. This is what I need individual contributors who are listening to the podcast to really hear. Making those inroads, making those connections, making the, you know, building out a public facing API for yourself so that you can interface with salespeople, marketers, legal teams, HR folk, the other people managers throughout the rest of the organization. These are the things that make your career resilient in ways that just focusing on the code cannot, because
Amen.
As the IT side of the house has seen, as soon as we can figure out a way to not have to deal with you people, we will do that. Whether that be outsourcing or replacing your ass with a GPT system or a no-code system, or, you know, hell, we're going to move over to Squarespace so we don't need a web team anymore. Something like this. It's only through those interpersonal connections that your value is really going to be seen, because at the end of the day, you don't write software because the code is valuable. You write software to solve real business problems. And until an IC gets that shift, they are always going to be on the bubble for the next set of layoffs. What types of instruction, or what, aside from just experiencing it through having a consultant like yourself come in, what ways have you seen that allow people to really ingrain that within themselves?
So it starts with, I think, realizing that you, in basically any position, have a lot more agency and a lot more wiggle room than you might think. And probably the number one complaint I hear from CEOs is, I want my executives to come to me and tell me what we need to do, not come to me and keep asking me questions. And this, you know, it trickles down. It's the same at most levels. If you take the initiative, if you speak up and say, I think we need to try this, you're going to be listened to, because most times, you know, everyone everywhere is so bombarded. We have so many things to do. If you have a suggestion for something that can actually help us with something that's important, you're not, you know, I have an idea for how we can update that framework we're using so things are going to be tighter. We're going to make sure that we use code that's going to be not obsolete at end of life in 5 years. I'm talking about something that's right now on fire, but something that's really, really preemptive. No one cares about that. But if you take a step back and you talk about those things, that you suggest things that matter right now, people are going to listen. And if you're going to be responsible, if you're going to say, you know, let me try it, or I think we can do it if you give me X days, stuff like that. In my experience, globally, more often than not, you're going to get the opportunity, because we're all looking for people to help us. If you can help me reduce the load, you're not adding things on my plate, you're actually taking things off it, I'm not going to tell you no. I'm going to tell you, heck yeah, go ahead. Right. And if you embrace that mindset, you can achieve amazing things. And this is actually also connected to, if you're an IC listening, realize that a year of experience is not the same, you know, in any company, in any sort of role. And this is sort of like the theory of relativity, right? It depends on how fast you're moving, and time feels differently. And I keep seeing that there are these companies where a year is more like, you know, 10 days, because you don't learn anything. And others where a year is like 10, because it's an experience pressure cooker. You learn so much, things move rapidly. You're, and especially if you are attuned to this and you soak it up, you can just learn faster and more rapidly than anyone else around you. And sometimes I see people who have like only 3 or 4 years of experience who are amazing, mind-bogglingly amazing, because they made sure that every day they had was a day that mattered. And it's possible. You don't have to be working on, you know, to be on one of those rocket ships that are going from one engineer to 500 in 2 years and feel like this is the only way for me to achieve that. I've seen that happen in companies that are way, way smaller if you actually learn to leverage whatever's possible. So change your mindset to allow yourself to speak up, suggest ideas. Actually, you know, I say that it's okay to elbow your way into some meetings, to be a fly on the wall. As long as you're getting your tasks done, people are probably not going to tell you not to join that customer interview, or at least ask for a recording to watch later and stuff like that. And that can give you so much context, and then you can have more ideas and it can help everyone. And these are the people who usually go up the ranks really, really fast, because they keep looking around and saying, what's more possible? What else can we do? They're not just content with whatever Jira is feeding them today, trying to think about what really would be the best use of my time. What really can I do right now that will deliver amazing impact? And you know, one of the taglines I sometimes use is, we're aiming to triple impact per engineer. That does not mean that engineers are going to be going clickety-clacky three times as fast. Usually, that's not the bottleneck. The bottleneck is that we're doing so many things. We have so much craft that doesn't really matter. And if you, as an engineer, really understand what's the goal, you always have your sights on what matters, your ideas are going to be, your shower thoughts are going to help you get there. Every step you take, or the vast majority of them, are going to be in the right direction. And therefore, you're going to be moving and getting to your destination a lot faster than the companies around you, than the average engineer. And again, we want to create teams that are worth leading, not just another average team, because life's too short for that.
I think you've got the topic for your third book right there, because yes, if you expand the theory of relativity to your impact as an engineer, time does move faster as you get closer to the center of gravity. The center of gravity, in my mind, is the people experiencing the problem you're there to solve. I think what a lot of engineers, or a lot of ICs, or a lot of people going up through different organizations believe is that the theory, the center of gravity, are based on job titles within their organization. What is it that you see as being sort of the focal point that the closer you get to, it's going to accelerate your growth and your touch and your impact?
I think that in most companies, even if you're not openly invited, making sure that you're privy to what's happening business-wise is almost like magic. It's a hack to really help you gain a bunch of context and be connected directly to the one thing that's always going to be important. Just as you said, those people who are disengaged and only thinking about the tech part are the first on the chopping block when things get rough and we have to have layoffs, or there's a technological advancement that allows us to make them redundant, or we want to move to outsource or whatever. The opposite is those people who really get the business, who really understand what we're going for, who can help the business people with ideas, because all of a sudden they have a sparring partner that they can talk to, who sees things differently, who comes from a different background, who doesn't have all of the prejudice and the assumptions they already possess to talk to. This is sometimes making yourself worth your weight in gold. And I've seen that. I've seen the magical engineers who realize that they don't have to, you know, become an amazing salesperson in order to be able to talk about business or to talk to the salespeople. You just need to have this sort of Socratic method questioning that we do when you debug really, really well. You do this process. You start by looking at something and say, okay, when did it break? What happened? Is this happening all the time or only when specific types of issues happen, et cetera, et cetera? And you pinpoint the exact problem. If you're able of doing the same in things that aren't just code, if you talk to the business people, if you talk to the users, if you see what people are, you know, even just commenting about the company on Twitter and learning from that, you're going to be able to provide the company with a bunch of insight, with a bunch of ideas, and sometimes just even just facilitating a good discussion that's going to help turn the ship to the right direction, going to help provide value, and in a sense, build for yourself a career that you're going to be proud of, because you weren't just a keyboard jockey. You delivered impact. Whatever you did had results. And I think that's important. Even, you know, if you end up working for a startup that failed, if you help them to validate things faster, if you help them improve, if you help them learn, you did what you had to do. Like when I was in my first year in service, I had a bit of a curse. I had like three systems in a row that I was working on that pretty much as we were ready to ship them, or a week after we shipped them, they became no longer necessary. You know, imagine that you read that some terror organization had a work accident, that place is now gone, or we ended up having a war with Lebanon, and all of a sudden a bunch of the stuff we worked on was no longer necessary. Syria had the Arab Spring, a lot of the things that we thought we needed to prepare for were no longer necessary. I worked on systems to help get intelligence from all of those, and all of a sudden it was no longer necessary. And yeah, I was a bit bummed, but I never told myself, you know, that this was useless or what was I even doing, because I knew at every turn that I was doing the thing that at the time was the most important thing. And I knew that I wasn't wasting time. So even if you end up not seeing the results as you wanted, you can feel the fulfillment of knowing you did things that were worthwhile. And if you stick with it long enough, you're going to see a bunch of value at the end, because eventually things are going to work out. Eventually, I did things that I think really helped my country. Eventually, in my career, I ended up working on projects that were company saving moments and that sort of stuff. And that's possible if you keep your sights on what really matters.
A lot of that. So we're talking about this in the context of an individual contributor. Now, as a leader of teams myself, both as an engineering manager and then eventually as VP of engineering, I took it upon myself. And now as a coach, I teach my people who are engineering managers, VPs of engineering, CTOs, et cetera, to provide that context to their teams and provide the context of their teams to the outside organizations. So one of the things that I loved doing as VPE is a weekly newsletter where I gave the context of what the business was thinking and where the business was going to my teams. And then in the same newsletter, I talked about what my teams were working on in the terms of business cases for everybody else that was reading it. I found that to be a very valuable tool. And I also think my teams found that very valuable as well. What role, so is it incumbent upon an individual contributor to do this, or should we be teaching more of the engineering leadership that this is what they should be doing for their teams as part and parcel of their role?
So I think that if you consider what's ideal, ideally the people who are managers who have this sort of a role should be taught. What does it mean to be a manager? Again, we're going to the management as a real profession thing we talked about earlier. And then these people should have, you know, at least part of the time, have this hat on of thinking, how am I helping translate and bridge the gap between my team and the outside world and vice versa? And this is something that should be happening. However, I think that everyone who's a senior engineer or aspiring to become a senior engineer has to possess these capabilities as well, because a senior engineer is not just someone who possesses the tech mastery, is able to do projects that are complex, but usually a good senior engineer, in my book, when I help my clients, and probably you've seen it as well in your career, a senior engineer that stands out is one that is able of taking things off your plate. And for them to do that, they don't have to be managers. They just need to be able to be the kind of person that you can rely on to talk to other people without you needing to be there, to raise the flag if something's needed, to help other people understand what they're working on. So if you as an engineer, we have this thing where we're talking, you know, Chinese or what might have been might as well have been Chinese for the rest of the organization. They can come up to you with something and you can say, oh no, the thingamajig proxy has to be updated and Git won't let me do that unless we push the right way, and the CI system will only let me do that once every full moon. And you can just keep saying those things and people will just say, okay, no, they really don't know if what you're saying makes sense or not. We have this armor of jargon. And this is the same for me when I take my car to the shop and they can tell me that they need to replace the gas powder. I'm like, okay, I didn't know we have that. If you say so, you just do it. And we need to make sure that we don't allow ourselves to use that sort of a hack, but we always try and communicate, you know, as if I'm explaining to my late grandma what I'm trying to do, or why that would work, or as if I'm trying to understand what she wants. Not by getting, you know, I need this button to do that and say, okay, I'm going to do that, or asking a bunch of details like, how should the button look? but say, why do you need that button to do that? What would that achieve? What would be the end goal? Because maybe I can make it automatic. You don't need to press any buttons. It's just going to happen every day, or whatever. And I keep telling engineers when I coach them that the one thing they can do, the simplest hack to become better, is to keep on asking a bunch of why. You know, just ask why. Some of them have these post-it notes, just say why on them, next to them, to remind them that it's okay to ask that. And I teach managers I work with that if they feel like they're not getting enough questions, your role is to start trying to tease those questions out. Give them space to ask questions. Wait, you know, even if it's an uncomfortable silence, sit and wait for them to ask something. Because when we ask, we learn better. And when you make that a habit where people see that we can ask and we get answers, and you know, there really is no stupid question, etc., it really helps. And if you do that from the end, from the point of view of the manager, and from the point of view of an IC, ideally, you get first to be reckoned with.
Wonderful. One of the things that you're touching on there is the role of what it means to be more senior in the role of software engineering. And one of the challenges, at least here in the US, I don't know how the market works in Israel specifically, but there is no standardization around what it means to be a junior engineer, a software engineer, a senior engineer, principal, staff, what have you. Same when we get into the leadership space, when we're talking about architects, when we're talking about QA, when we're talking about product, there is really no clear thing except that you've had the seat for at least a couple of years. So when you lean into, and I'm in full agreement, that movement from software engineer into senior software engineer is more of taking on a contextual aspect of things, not just a deeper understanding of the software package. How do we get that to be more universal? Let's get it more universal. That's gaining in seniority means the ability to explain it to a wider audience.
Yeah, so I'll say that if we're talking about one of, you know, a big tech company, they have to have very structured, formalized career ladders. And okay, I get that. Once you're that big, it happens. But usually, even when I'm working with unicorns and companies that freshly IPO, I told them that you probably will get more benefit from keeping things changed. And I kind of keep saying to my clients, you don't need more principal engineers, you need more product engineers. You need people who care about the end result, to have this context. And therefore, I always try and create a system where people get their feeling of moving forward in the organization, in their careers, not just by getting, you know, that next rung on the ladder, getting the next title to put on LinkedIn, but also by being able to tell a story of what your impact was. So if you were the technical feature lead of the flagship feature your company worked on this year, that's something that's amazing, and something that I think just a principal title would not help as much. And if you can help people get this responsibility, get this sense of ownership, that's something that's a lot harder as a manager to manage. But maybe now with the shifts that we're seeing, with teams going more towards the smaller scale, with growth becoming more organic again, and with companies driving for revenue, driving towards business results and not just growing for the sake of growing and having a bunch of vanity metrics going on, now I think it's even easier to create these sorts of cultures where people show their worth by helping achieve results. And that's what we celebrate. You know, what we celebrate in the company are the five individuals who are ICs, but really helped get these big objectives delivered this year. And I do that because I just point blank say it's, I think, almost impossible to define a very cleanly structured career ladder so you can systematically say this person is clearly no longer just a senior engineer, they need to get a staff engineer, whatever. There's a reason why, you know, for example, again, I'm talking a lot about the Army. I only served for like 4 years, okay? Don't think I'm like some sort of a general. But still, there's a reason why a lot of the rank, a pressure cooker of experience. But there's a reason why a lot of the ranks initially, at least in the way the IDF works, the Israeli Defense Force works, you get those purely by time. So as you said, like you transition from junior to engineer to senior, you get your ranks, you know, you get corporal after X months, sergeant after X more months, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just to show that we reckon that you've been here, you're gaining experience and time passes. But as I said, as a corporal, I got to have more of an effect on a big project than a lieutenant general had because I had a better idea. And I don't think that lieutenant general felt like, oh, this kid is taking my spot, or I didn't feel like I'm more important than that lieutenant general because I had an idea and, you know, he outranks me. It's just purely about the fact that that day I moved the needle, and it's just another thing that I still remember now, 17 years later, and I'm proud of it. And we can create those. And is it harder? Yeah, it is harder. And as a manager, not just having something that you can by rote say, yeah, you're gonna get your next rank, you're gonna get your next promotion if you just keep on doing these and make sure to work on a project with the team from overseas so it looks good in your promotion package. It is harder to actually coach your people and help them generally become better at what they do, help them actually feel like what they're doing matters, help them have impact. But again, management is a profession. You're not a babysitter in a tech company. You're someone who should be a force multiplier within the organization. And it is harder to have these, which is why I think we should strive for smaller teams. We should strive to have less of these and be able to invest in each and every one. So everyone becomes this sort of a nugget of amazing value for the company. And this is something that for many might seem easier said than done. But again, it just so happens that right now the stars are aligning and many companies are going to go in this direction. So now is your opportunity to experiment, because what if you get to lose?
Yeah, indeed. And so I'm in broad agreement with all of those things, because management being a profession, seeing that there is a role, and I think largely ignoring that fact is what has led to the ballooning of many of the larger tech organizations. I don't think the issue is the salaries as such. I think the issue is the willy-nilly handing out of titles without true meaning behind them. Because even in a Meta, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Twitter, X, whatever the hell they want to call it this week, type of environment, we've worked with people from all of those organizations. Even with the latter, the title's meaningless, except as a means to an end for what meetings you get invited to and what your salary would end up being. I want to turn the page, though. We talked earlier on about the dream scenario for you right now, where you have time for your wife, you have time for your children, you have time to work with these wonderful organizations. Expand that dream further into the future for me, please. What would have to be true for 5 years from now, you're still telling people at cocktail parties, yeah, I am absolutely living the dream?
Well, I think naturally I'll have to be still feel like I'm challenged. Like I'm not doing things that are automatic for me to think about. I don't want to feel like I'm repeating the same advice, but I'm always being challenged. Partly that's why I'm working more with CEOs and CPOs now, and then just with the tech executives. Partly where I'm helping some companies form strategy at a higher level, because I think that once you have a good strategy, it's an amazing engine to drive context. So I'm guessing more of those sort of healthy evolutions of finding ways to increase my impact. And also, I found that things like the books, like the videos and podcasts I have, this podcast, another podcast I'm guesting on, these help me get the message across to a lot more people. And there's just something so nice about getting an email from, some remote country, from someone who's fighting the good fight in their company and telling you how that book or that interview or that article helped them get their team, make things better. They really are seeing the value of that. So even if I'm not working with them one-on-one, I can feel like th this is worth it, and the knowledge I'm gaining and then sharing is being spread and helping the entire industry. And for me, I think that's a big chunk of it, seeing the globality of what they're doing and seeing more and more people learning and creating these career highlights that they're gonna cherish forever. For me, that's the secret.
Wonderful, beautiful. You know what I noticed is in all of that, there was no aspect of management software or management tool software or to-do task software or other pieces of, well, software. There is a corner of our industry that is trying to automate those things, just like they're trying to automate everything else. How do you see software for managers or software targeted at management impacting how we go about fighting the good fight?
So I will say that I've worked with several companies who do that, or trying to do that. And I believe that there's something there, because as with anything, software can help certain things better and help make certain things better. And I think that if we do it correctly, we don't turn it into a form of like the sort of industrial keeping track of how fast you move loads, like we had 100 years ago when people were trying to come up with how to optimize things. But instead, you use it in order to give your managers who are learning to be real managers, give them something that allows them to more easily see whether the work they're putting is paying off, if they can see that in general the teams are getting faster in general, we have less quality issues, people are talking with more between the different departments, whatever you want to track. If you do that, I think that can really help you. And time is the most precious thing we have. If you can save me time by pinpointing this team seems to be doing worse than they usually have been in the past year, and you can say, okay, there's a problem there. What happened there? Well, we have a new manager there, or they just got a new project or a new PM. That if you get that contact, it can really help, open your eyes and help you be more effective as a leader. So I do believe in these things driving a lot of impact down the line. However, as with anything else, I fear of them being misused. And I just actually have a new article out saying no one cares about your R&D metrics. So I've seen a bunch of VPEs who have these DORA metrics, and they actually come to me and say, Aviv, how do I present these to the board? I want them to see what we're doing. And I'm like, they don't care. It's like, I don't know how much horsepower my car has. The board shouldn't care about how many deploys you have a day. It doesn't matter. Maybe you have 100 deploys because you have a convoluted system with more microservices than engineers, and every change requires 100 deploys. Does that make anything meaningful? Does that mean that what you're doing is good or not? I've seen companies who have a weekly release and actually beat all their competitors because that single weekly release did better. So make sure that you're not just measuring for the sake of measuring. Make sure that whatever you're doing is always with the right intention. How do I make my team better? How do I, as a manager, as a leader, find when to put my attention and help raise the bar constantly? We always have to be improving. And if we improve by a tiny bit every day, it really compounds. And a year from today, you're going to see a team that's doing things that you thought were not possible.
Wonderful. What else do you wish organizations knew that they just don't? And that's a part of your job to tell them now, but it's not the part of your job you love.
Well, I think that something that I find like I'm a broken record with is we have to keep telling people that just because engineers are geeks or don't come from a business background, it doesn't mean that they need to stay like that. It doesn't mean that they need to be pigeonholed or siloed. And this is something that I keep repeating both to the technical people and to the business people. And I think that we, you know, we need to get past that way of looking at the world. We're all smart, intelligent people working together. We come from a diverse background, and actually let's leverage that. Let's accept the fact that we, if we bring people who have different opinions, different backgrounds into the room, we're going to get more ideas, more creativity, as opposed to trying to always have these conversations in a forum that's that's comprised of a bunch of people who are basically the same or who are thinking the same and the same, you know, vice versa. I think that a lot of the times engineers fall into this mode of thinking, you know, in the same manner, just like you see those groups of tiny fish in the ocean who all move together left and right. I see engineers doing the same. You got a bunch of very, very smart people, but they all seem to lack individual opinion. And I want to break that. And once you understand that every individual has the capability to talk business if they want to understand a bit of the tech if needed, once you do that, we all become 3D. Okay, right now I'm seeing you on Zoom, you're 2D, but I believe that you're a real person. You're a three-dimensional being somewhere on the other end of the universe for me. And I think that we can do that within organizations and see things just become so much more fulfilling for everyone in the company, because you stop feeling like everyone around me is an idiot and you start looking at, oh, so many people around me, I'm betting one of them can help me with what I'm currently struggling with.
Wonderful. Yes. Three-dimensional people. And, you know, I got to say, that's the first time I've ever heard somebody ask for engineers to be more opinionated.
Yeah, that, I need to be careful what I wish for.
Yeah, you do, at least in this regard. That covers the things that I wanted to talk about, Aviv. Is there anything else you wanted to bring to the table?
No, that's about it. And if anyone's interested to hear more, you can go to avivbinyosef.com and see me blab on about much of this a lot more.
That was going to be my next final question, which is, where else can people find you? So you've got avivbinyosef.com, and where else can people find you?
Well, I'm mostly on Twitter or X or whatever it's called, AvivBY. And in general, if you go to my website, there's my email there, and I respond to everything. And if you want, dear listener, you can also check out my Leading Edge Club. It's a free community for startup executives. We have over 100 people globally, just launched it a little while ago. And we're working on helping people together become better as executives. Well, again, just like with managers, a lot of us are not getting the right training and the right tools. And if you work with similarly minded people and you meet more peers, you can just do it a lot faster. So we're trying to create this sort of an experience pressure cooker for everyone else.
Wonderful. Thank you, Aviv. And yes, I wholly agree. Leadership is a profession. You should treat it as a profession, and you should treat it as something that you want to be as good at as quickly as possible. Awesome. It's been great speaking with you today, Aviv, and I look forward to many more future conversations.
It's been great, Rob. Thank you.
And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero. And it is such a fun ride finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.